This material is subject to copyright. No unauthorized recording, editing, copying, or distribution is permitted without the consent of the Economic Research Council. All rights reserved. For more information, visit www.ercouncil.org. Audio lectures by the Economic Research Council.
So let's get the first thing out of the way. Yes, I'm afraid it's another hairy Scot coming from north of the wall down to tell you how to run the asset management industry. If you don't like what I say today about digital, I'm going to completely blame Tom Chatfield for that, because he actually set me on this path about 18 months ago. We were both speaking out in Hong Kong. I was speaking about something actually fairly boring. I was talking about alignment of value chains between advisors and the investors. And, you know, you're in the speaking lounge and you do what you do. You start talking to each other. And lo and behold, Tom's this digital writer. I went, okay, that's quite interesting. And I sat in on his session and he talked about the digital changes that are happening in China. And we start getting talking. And then yesterday, I was over actually listening to Tom, and he was talking about digital humans over at the Portcullis. And this was a government-sponsored event, and talking about how we can change our skills for the new digital age. And there was one thing that was said, actually, at that panel, which I disagreed with, and Tom knows this. They talked about the digitalization, the robotization of low-skill jobs, blue-collar workers, and repetitive tasks. Now, I've worked in the financial industry for 20 years, and if there's one thing I know, there's a lot of repetitive tasks in the financial industry. And then it got me thinking even more after really speaking with Tom about what I do. I guess this maybe gives me some substance to talk to you today about why I think digitalization is maybe important to the new fund order. And that's basically having started in compliance for my sins. I was given the opportunity to start setting up client portfolios and to start selecting fund managers for my consultants in my advisory firm. And as you can imagine, that's a huge steep learning curve. It's like climbing a mountain, but it was exciting. I was in my young 20s, and when you're in your young 20s, you think you can do everything and you can learn everything. And then to some degree, your brain is kind of hardwired like a sponge. And so if you take lots on board. And I realised I was actually not particularly bad at this. I was actually quite good. So for the next 16 years, I've actually stayed analysing fund managers, selecting fund managers, going into fund managers, fixing their problems, breaking down their asset allocation models, challenging their stochastic assumptions, looking at the portfolio holdings, and trying to, bit by bit, fund by fund, try and improve the outcomes for our investors, for our customers. And heaven forbid, if you come across the next Madoff or the next Arch Crew, hit the big red button and do something about it before it's too late. And then that draws us to this notion that I wrote this book last year called The New Fund Order. And some people ask me, what do I mean by New Fund Order? And in some ways, it's actually easier to define it if we first talk about how the city operates. And for the purposes of doubt, when I talk about the city today, I talk about the fund management and the asset management and wealth management industry in London and in the UK. So what I will try and talk to you about is some of the dysfunctions I see in the asset management industry today. I'll try and build this idea of value chains and what I mean by optimum economic value. And then lastly, we can then get into some of the disruptors that are perhaps catalysing change slowly in some parts, quickly in others, sometimes silently, sometimes quite loudly. And then hopefully at the end we'll have a little bit of time for Q&A and for perhaps the more partisan in the audience a chance to write a reply and perhaps put me on the other end. So there is no formula here. When I talk about economic value chains, I'm talking about the journey from the point the investor hands his money over to the point where he gets his money back. In the old fund order, that journey is extremely complicated. It's complicated because of regulation, it's complicated because of legacy, it's complicated because of product design, and it's also complicated because many people are involved in the value chain. One way to think about the old fund order is a traditional actively managed fund sold by a financial advisor through a distributing platform for a pension wrapper. What you get is lots of pound signs, custodians, auditors, legal fees, the advisor themselves, the advisor support services, the para planner, the index referencing company, the performance system provider. Very complex. What does the new fund order look like? The new fund order is line B. It's the unicorn. We haven't achieved it yet. But what's happening in terms of disruptors in our industry is this is what they're aiming for. Fewer points of contact, fewer costs, still trying to deliver an acceptable outcome to the end customer. I'd love to say this was my cat because he's quite nice. But the old fund order is based on what I call asset management 1.0 model. It's known as the annual management charge. The AMC works particularly well for the city because it's based on scale. Your earnings are based on the AMC. How much AMC you charge is based on how much you can sweat those assets. If you can sweat those assets more, you can then charge a premium and you can keep a compact book. If you're not able to sweat those assets, as is increasingly becoming the case in our industry, then to offset that potential loss of earnings, what is happening in the AMC model is players are increasing the size of assets that they're managing in order to protect their earnings. Unfortunately, that AMC model generates some unusual biases and behaviours in our industry, and it also leads to asset concentration, which I believe is detrimental to the long-term competition of the asset management industry. And indeed, the AMC does have some of its detractors. I would certainly point you towards Professor Andrew Clare at Cass and his fairly radical paper on symmetrical performance fees, which I could tell you when it was released had that kind of sound in the industry. It wasn't particularly well received. I also think it's perhaps too utopian and unworkable, but it is a signpost as to perhaps where the new fund order is heading. And indeed, the city has had it oh so good. Really, from what was quite a woeful time in 2001, the fund management industry, the asset management industry at large, has expanded threefold, according to E&Y. Indeed, my colleague at the Association of Professional Fund Investors, Roland Meter, was one of the first guiding lights to actually indicate that perhaps there was something untoward in our business model and that this notion of blockbuster funds wasn't necessarily a good thing in the long run. But I'm empathetic to the city of why they would want to hang on to the asset management 1.0 model. Scale brings many advantages. It brings economies of scale. It helps your operational baseline. You can increase your earnings by building book. It gives you some degree of margin resilience in the downturns, or indeed where there is disruptors in the market like ETFs and the move to more digitalized solutions. And so I am empathetic towards why the AMC model might be actually attractive and might be something that the city would like to hang on to. But unfortunately, what I'm observing, both in the US, Europe, and in indeed the UK, is that there are some severe disadvantages of building supersized funds and supersized fund businesses. For one, it certainly increases your redemption risk. What I've observed is those largest of the asset managers no longer are really in control of the asset mix, the holder mix that are actually investing into their funds anymore. They take on some degree of, sort of systemic behaviour, and that makes them susceptible to runs in the market when people suddenly become very risk averse. Indeed, many of the largest funds I've observed start to lose some of their performance advantage. They lose some of the nimbleness in the markets that they trade in. And indeed, because they become bigger, then because of the regulatory onus forced upon the city, risk management itself somehow becomes counterproductive to performance. I know of one very well-known multi-asset diversified growth fund in the UK today, indeed one of the fastest-selling diversified growth funds in the day-to-day, that has to hold nigh on $10 billion in cash and cash equivalents constantly. It holds a combination of $3 billion in overnight and the remainder in a 25 CD ladder in order to hold the liquidity, and not just to manage the weekly cash flow coming through the fund, but because that fund engages in futures. And because of risk management practices, it holds its cash requirement against margin for those futures at a 7x multiple. Well, as that franchise continues to get bigger and bigger and bigger, it's not hard to see how that, in a period of low nominal interest rates and QE, can be damaging to the performance. The question that we then have to ask ourselves in this city is, what does a strategy that size have to do to continue to deliver the returns? I think it's a very prudent question to ask. And of course, we are where we are, not just because of the fund managers. It'd be wrong to just blame the big fund houses. There's lots we can blame the big fund houses for, but it's wrong to blame them for everything. Now, the fund buyer community in London, and indeed in the UK, is quite a small church. It's quite a small village. And most of us know each other. And reflecting on my own biases and indeed of those of my friends, we do get these symptoms that come out of the old fund order. Star manager culture, I think many of you would recognise. It has been part of the DNA of the asset management community really for the past 20 years, since CityWire and Investment Week decided to put fund managers on the front covers and turn them into celebrities. Now, if some of you know some of these fund managers, they are the anti-celebrity. Some of them are introverted, they're eccentric. These people don't want to be on the front cover, but the demands and the pressures of marketing force them into the limelight. Now, I, for one, absolutely bought Anthony Bolton and Neil Woodford at the turn of the millennium. But back then, our notion of big was when a fund manager got over 1 billion in size. Today, before its peak, before Bill Gross, Lynn left for Jairus, PIMCO total return was well over 200 billion in size. That fund in September 2014 lost over 20 billion in outflows. These numbers are crazy. How did this happen? It happened because the proprietary books of banks and the size of defined benefit pension schemes were forced to contract. Defined benefit schemes contracted because companies were forced to hold more and more capital to cover the long-term liability, and banks were forced, as a punitive exercise post-2008, to retract their balance sheets and their proprietary trading desks. What we've done is just shifted the risk into the shadow market. And that shadow market has a face. It's the fund manager that's on the front magazine when you lift up the magazine. It's the guy you're looking at. It's the celebrities. It's the people they put out there. Asset management has become the new home for casino banking. And then if you look at some of these other fund buyer biases, many of these things aren't, you know, they're done for the right reasons. We've all studied the same books. We're in a way herded towards doing the same thing. Core satellite portfolio theory has really been on the go since the 1960s. And when we had the Big Bang in the 80s and then started buying funds like there was no tomorrow through the 90s, we tended to build them in core satellite portfolios. The problem there is that what you do is you end up getting a drip effect. There's a degree of game theory that kicks in with fund buyers that kind of drives you towards basically putting, everyone puts the same money to the same fund manager as the safe choice. And then what then everyone tries to do is diversify the rest of their book to try and be innovative. Harris and Cooper did a great study a couple of years ago that actually showed that the majority of wealth managers were actively trying to buy boutiques, not buy the supersized funds. But these things then don't join up until you start looking at how sometimes portfolios are put together through core satellite theory. Meanwhile, getting back to the asset managers, what's been happening within the IMA universe is that really the 10 largest firms have really been trying to soak up all of the assets in the market at an alarming rate. And one of the ways they've been doing that is through M&A. So M&A activity, if you look through the asset management, and you could quote, you could look at any of examples. Schroders buys Cazenove. Investec buys Debrow. Aberdeen buys SWIP. There is a constant trend where basically the largest asset management firms see that they can't sweat their AMCs on their book anymore, and therefore they're going to be in this process of actually trying to build these kind of supersized books. And then, of course, to try and match those assets, what we've then seen is the portfolio desks of the largest firms balloon. And, you know, when you start to look at, say, for example, an equity desk at one of the largest firms, and there's 130 professionals supposedly driving equity ideas into a handful of funds, then something's wrong there. And, you know, maybe it doesn't apply, but my observation is when you have too many people trying to think through an investment process, then you do start to get these coefficients of inefficiency. Anyone who's read the 58 paper by Parkinson will recognise Parkinson's law. It's not the most exciting paper, I have to say, and actually talks about little government, but the rules still apply. And then lastly, that asset concentration that is really the culmination of everything that you see before you ends in what I call these supertanker funds. And you know, this got a little bit of coverage really because of what's happening in the high-yield debt space in the US and really what's happening to fixed income funds generally. There is a massive liquidity issue out there, and funds that are super in size can't trade anymore. They cannot trade at the size that they need, unless if they're just lucky enough to pick up the phone and the shadow banking market is at the other end and willing to do them a price and the spread doesn't blow up. But there is a ticking bomb there. What I would suggest to people, particularly in the fixed income market, is run away from all the really exciting bond managers, the guys that are really good at talking the talk. And I would say go back to the guys that have been running fixed income funds for 30, 40 years. The prudent guys. The guys who understand that a bond is about clipping a coupon and making sure that the debtor at the other end doesn't default. Unfortunately, what happened was we made fixed income funds interesting and exciting, and we think they would be dynamic and they should be cleverer than perhaps they really are. And, you know, we've seen this obviously in the IMA pattern. We've seen strategic bond funds and absolute return bond funds become extremely popular because they're trying to reinvent the wheel, and just perhaps the physical market isn't able to cover that. And that brings us to this point of the new fund order. And I do believe we have already reached the tipping point between the old model and where we're heading to. I actually think we actually passed it in 2009 because of the credit crisis. So that was a catalyst. Meanwhile, we had an explosion of fintech, financial technology, and far greater acceleration in digitalization outside of the asset management community. So basically, technology is moving faster than our industry. Meanwhile, we have these negative behaviours and biases to try and contend with. This is why I think we're now passing this tipping point. This is why I think we're now moving to a new business model. And I'll let you just scan some of the things there I've said, and I don't think anything will come as a surprise. We've seen a sharp spike in investor action groups. We've seen the rise of negative and challenging financial media. And certainly we've seen this idea of fee compression coming through. And this then drives this idea of optimum economic value, or what I call OEV. And indeed, you can see it in the buying patterns already. And I think most of these should be familiar to you. An increase in multi-asset, a race towards passive, a race towards supposedly smart beta, depending on which side of that argument you stand. Certainly James Montier and John Bogle have had pretty negative things to say about smart beta, but I think in essence and in philosophy, what it's trying to do might be worth considering. The victims of the new fund order, and certainly the buying patterns of investors, are the traditional actively managed building block funds. Funds that are put together by wealth managers, funds that are historically bought by insurance companies and put on platforms. These funds are all in perpetual outflow. And then you can ask yourself, say, well, why? Why is that the case? And I would argue to you that this is evidence of the new fund order. This is evidence that the value chain is becoming shorter and it's becoming more direct. Why? Because the use of building block funds requires then someone to put it together into a portfolio or to apply an asset allocation. It's an extra step in the process. And investors seem to be unwilling and less prepared today to then pay for that. And this then brings us back to the digitalisation. And I know Patrick Murphy and Pure Group is in the audience today. And it is really people like him, and indeed, I think some of the sort of the guiding light that Tom Chatfield has put on this area. None of this is going to stop happening. All of this is now racing along. Blockchain is probably going to be one of the largest changes in the banking industry for 50 years. Once that technology is embedded into the banking sector, there will be a natural spillover into asset management. And, you know, we can see the fight that is being fought right now about robo-advisors. Everyone is arming up their academic papers and engaging the media as to perhaps why robo-advisors are the next evil of our industry. And you know what? The robo-advisors is going to go through growing pains. Absolutely, it's going to go through growing pains. It's going to be like everything else in our industry. There's good, there's bad, and there's ugly. But we are on a journey, and that journey is continuing, and it's continuing at a fast pace. But maybe I got this wrong. For what it's worth, this is a 2014 slide about the move country by country towards passive. The 2015 figures have blown this out of the water already. And at the moment, what's been happening in passive land is the assets have been concentrating around like the giants of BlackRock. That's a short-term symptom. My hope is what we'll then see in the passive space is exactly what I hope for the active space, which is more proliferation, more boutique providers, more competition, and more choice. But I don't think I've got the trend wrong. The trend towards passive is happening. The evolution of ETFs is happening. The technology is supporting it, and the investors are buying it. And I really do believe we're at the tip of the iceberg on this one. And I'm literally about to finish, so that will give an opportunity for that question, which has just emerged. And if there's one thing I would just leave you with, other than obviously the link to my book, is the old world is most definitely built on size in the AMC, whereas this new world is definitely built on this notion of optimum economic value. And then the plug on the book. Media mogul Lawrence Gosling said my book was challenging. I'm not sure if that was a grammar thing. Tom, I think, said my book was blunt. And Firebrand journalist Robin Powell said my book was fascinating. And if you happen to like 70s spy films, like I like 70s spy films, Gorky Park, Ipcress File, and you perhaps want to explore the darker side of the city, then just maybe. Thank you.